it's terrific to have you here. You were actually one of the first people that I met out in the broader community when I came to Vancouver about 5.5 years ago. I had just come from a job where I worked for an organization that brought together unions and faith communities. And so when I came here, I was very eager to get to know some of the local labor leaders. And you, at the time, were both the president of Local 4 for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, and also the president for the Labor Council for the Southwest Washington area. And I remember being very impressed because I thought, this is a fairly young guy. I thought of myself as a young minister, probably still, some people still do. And I thought, wow, this is a young guy who's doing a lot as a labor leader at a young age. And I remember being impressed that you were the youngest to ever be elected president in both of those instances. So you were elected in 2003 to be the Labor Council president. How old would you have been at that time?
29.
Wow, 29.
28, 29.
Yeah, that's impressive. And so that makes me curious about what it was in your life up until that point that led you to being so active and involved in unions as a young person. Was it your family? Was it other influences or particular experiences that you had?
Well, I've benefited from the International Longshore and Warehouse Union my whole life. I'm third generation longshoreman, and like I said, in some way it's been there to help me and my family. So I guess it's kind of a story. I remember being out on the river with my dad and my grandfather, and a boat was in the middle of the river, broke down, and they were waving at us. We went over and we went to help them, and we towed them up to Camas. And when we got there, the guy that we helped came running over with $20, and he just giving it to my grandpa. And my grandpa's, no, forget it. You know, and I was a young kid. I was probably 7 or 8, and I was like, oh, that's $20 worth of candy. Take it. My grandpa's like, oh, no. And, you'd have done the same for me. And, it's kind of that, something I remember as far as you help people in need when they need it, and you shouldn't expect anything in return. And that's really kind of the feel I get from being a union member is, you help people in need, and you fight for the people that can't fight. And that's really what I appreciate about the union. And, let's face it, when you go to a picket line as a longshoreman with 5 other longshoremen, whether it's right or wrong, I mean, you feel like you're a knight in shining armor. People are on the picket line, locked out of their jobs, or on strike because their employers don't want to give the people, what they're worth. And people show up to give support. It's a morale boost to them, and it makes you feel good for doing the right thing.
All right, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, your union is in a heated battle with 3 companies operating grain terminals and seeking a new contract. And in talking with you and in reading things in the newspaper, to me, I think it brings to mind our scripture for today, because it seems to be a situation in which the truth is stumbling in the public square. And so I guess I'm wondering from you if there are some stories that you think people in the general public either aren't hearing, or they're hearing distorted stories.
Yeah, I would believe, something that people aren't hearing about our struggle is that United Grain Corporation, the corporation that has locked us out, they, before our old contract was even up, and before we got to the bargaining table, had already hired a security firm called Gettier Security from the East Coast, which prides themselves as being the one-stop union-busting security firm. And they're a paramilitary group, that provides everything from surveillance to replacement workers. And, you know, people, that story's not getting out there that our employers knew the direction that this was going and wanted to take us. We offered to roll over the old contract. They weren't having any. We agreed to quite a few concessions, and they still weren't interested. So they knew that this is where we were going to end up in some way, and that's where they wanted to be. As far as, the media, the newspapers, when we were still working in the facility and the security firm was brought in basically to watch us, we had an incident where we were returning to work and three very big security guards surrounded. Well, first they blocked one of the women that was going to her job. She was unloading rail cars. And they blocked her path, and she had to walk around, and they started laughing at her. And she sat down in the little buggy that she uses to unload rail cars, and they surrounded her. And one of the security guards bent down and got right in her face, and intimidating her to the point where she started to cry. She grabbed her hood and put it over her head. And another member saw it, and he walked over, and he pushed through those security guards, grabbed her, and pulled her out. And it really, really upset her, obviously, to the point where the next morning she decided she needed to file a police report. And the police came out, and they conducted their interviews, and the company was very hostile towards the police officer, even telling him that he had no business being there. So he said he was conducting a criminal investigation, that they need to go away, and they still persisted that he needed to be with somebody from management, and he had to get pretty stern with them and tell them that he would maybe had to arrest them for interfering with a criminal investigation. So this is something that has never made it out in the media, you know, and I should back up. When he was doing his investigation, he went to management and said, "Why did you surround this woman?" And they said they were worried about sabotage. And police officer said, "Okay, well, there was a man twice her size, 100 feet away. How come you didn't surround him with security?" And they had no answer. So it kind of shows you that really this security firm is all about provoking and trying to get a response that will give the company ammunition or fuel to say, "Look, we can't work with these people." I would say another story is once we were on the picket line, there's been a couple stories in the last couple weeks about the Columbia River pilots. And they were coming across our picket line, and our guys were picketing. We held them up, and one of the guys said to the driver, "You know, I see you have a wedding ring. You know, think about your wife. Think about your kids. You know, is this really something you think that they would be proud of? You crossing the line and helping the company destroy, you know, these union members and members of our community." And, of course, it's put in the paper that we threaten their wife and children. So, and, of course, that was Richard Reed, an Oregonian, and then the Oregonian editorial board. It is virtually impossible for us to get any kind of positive press. I would say the Colombians come fairly close to being neutral, but I would say leans more towards company. But you know, that's one of the problems we have is nobody knows our story.
Thanks for sharing that. Mm-hmm. As I reflect on this, it seems like there's at least three ways in which the truth is stumbling in the public square, and I think one element might be how the union is portrayed. You're giving some indication of that. I have a two-part question for you, which is, how do you see the union being portrayed currently in terms of, is it unfair or inaccurate? But then also, what do you want the public to know about the union and its members and who they are?
as far as being portrayed unfairly, going back to the editorial board, the first thing they brought up is they think that we've watched too many movies like Godfather and Donnie Brasco, you know, obviously making that connection to mafia. We are just normal people. You know, I go home every day to my wife and three children. We go down to the farmer's market. We go to Columbia Springs. We go up to the river to the fish ladders. I believe we're being vilified for fighting for our jobs and fighting for our union. For whatever reason, and the media's done a really good job of you know, making people who stand up at work, you know, painted as horrible people in the community. I think that's...
That's a helpful answer. I mentioned that I saw at least three ways that the truth is stumbling, and the third way that occurred to me, I was in the middle of reading an article by a labor writer named Dick Meister, and he wrote a piece once on labor in the media. And just to give some context about what Meister was talking about, he was talking about how from the Great Depression to the 1970s, relatively speaking, there was a lot more labor coverage in the media, that newspapers had labor reporters, and a number of newspapers had labor sections, not just a business section. And now we kind of take it for granted that there's just a business section, but when you think about it, it actually makes a lot more sense to have a labor section, because such a much larger percentage of the population would identify with a labor section as opposed to a business section. But our media has become just so slanted in such a systematic way that we now kind of take it for granted that the labor perspective is no longer covered. And so what he was saying is that because there's so little media coverage of labor these days compared to what there used to be, that when it is covered, it's these kind of very public, heated conflicts. And often what, you know, there's this insinuation of violence and so forth, or thuggishness on the part of unions, and they're covered like, you know, they're covering a war or an athletic event or something. And so what Meister says is that what's lacking now is that because it's so superficial and sensationalized that you no longer get a real explanation of why this conflict is occurring. You know, in many instances, what's the shoddy behavior of the employers that led up to this moment? Or what are the things going on behind the scenes that led up to this moment? And so I guess my question for you is, if you were to kind of explain to the general public, what led or what caused this lockout situation? How would you explain that? Because I think that's another element in which the truth is stumbling.
I would say it is just greed. We've been working there for 80 years. We've been a very productive workforce. I would say what they want is less about money and more about control. You know, they want to be able to do what they want when they want. And through our contract, we have, you know, 10-hour days, you know, no more. They want 12-hour days. They want to be able to hire and fire whoever they want for whatever reason. You know, stuff that's unacceptable, they just want more control. They don't like their workforce telling them, you know what, no, we're not going to work on Christmas. You know, we're not going to work on Thanksgiving. And those are all things that they wanted in the contract that we had problems with is, you know, holidays, 12-hour days. You know, I would like the ability to go to my son's T-ball game. And, you know, through the contract they had, you show up to work, they've got the right to start you between 7 and 9 in the morning and then work you till 7 or 9 at night with very little warning. That you show up, you think you're gonna work till 4 or 5, and then they say, oh, no, sorry, I know you're getting ready to leave and you got something to do, but we have to keep you here till 9. So it's just little things like that It's really, really kind of difficult to explain, but it is really about breaking the union's power. I mean, you've seen union places shut down, and they take apart the mill and they ship it overseas to the, you know, where they've got the lowest working conditions, the lowest environmental protections. The thing about our job is you can't export the docks. You know, you have to be able to take the commodity off the boat. You can't move the ports to China. It doesn't work that way. So we're pretty lucky in that they can't outsource our job to another country. And they see all these other corporations, not having to pay health benefits, not having to pay a living wage. And I believe that that's what they want. They want the ability to just squeeze every last nickel out of every corner they can, and we're one of those corners.
I guess I kind of want to bring this to a close now by looking for some sources of hope here. And I say, I think from my perspective, I'm brought back to our scripture for today. And whoever was writing Isaiah, this part of it, paints a really bleak picture of what's going on. And one has the sense that the writer feels very alone, that there's all these bad things happening and nobody's doing anything about it. But in the midst of this, the writer says that there is this divine hunger for justice. And that divine hunger for justice is going to be what rights wrongs. And to me, that means not that there's some divine hunger coming from the clouds or a mountaintop, but it's a divine hunger that can be seen in the determination, the resiliency, and the will of the union. And that theologically, we might say that when unions are at their best, God can be seen incarnate in the struggles of unions for justice and for what's right. And so, and hopefully that same divine hunger for justice can also be seen people in the broader community who hear the story and respond and join in solidarity with unions. And so that's kind of my source of hope. But where do you see some sources of hope?
I would say, the sources of hope, most of the members, whether they're third generation or fourth generation like me, or they're brand new off the street, they appreciate what the job gives them, which is a way to provide for their family and the ability to spend time with their family. And you just can't replace that. And having a job like that is worth fighting for. And, you know, we're not just co-workers. We refer to each other as brothers and sisters. And I'm closer to, 80% of my local than I am members of my own family. So my hope is, what gives me hope is that we're all together in this, and we're not going to go away. We know we're right. And what we want is justice. And I know that everybody in our local is going to, band together and do what it takes to get a good contract, to have a fair workplace, and we'll take it. We'll be there as long as it takes, and we'll do whatever we have to protect, ourselves, our families, our union, and our workplace. And just like this, being able to talk to members of the community and let them know that, what you're reading in the papers, there's another side to it. And, we're not the thugs that we're made out to be. We are members of this community. The money we make there, we spend in Vancouver. So my hope is that everybody, or the hope I have is that everybody realizes that this corporation is out to not only harm us, but is willing to harm the community, and that people will stand behind us and stick up for us if they hear somebody talking poorly of us. And it's, I know we'll get there. I really do. It'd probably be a long road, but like I said, the community's behind us, regardless of what the papers say, and we're in it to win it. So.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I came across an interesting quote this past week that said, "The subversive thing about labor is not the strike, but the idea of solidarity." And that resonated with me, because I think the same can be said of churches, is that when we care for each other and we care for people in the broader community, we often go against the grain. And so my hope is that we can continue to find common cause with each other as a church and as a union, and that we might be subversive together. So yes. We're glad to have you here. Let's give Cager a round of applause.
Thank you.